Of choice. Thanks for tuning, clicking, whatever way you got on. I don't check to see how many people are on board online. Welcome anyway, wherever you're listening from. Radio Free Labor will be back without Stephanie, but Bob has been testing negative after a bout with the virus. So happy he's out and about again and testing clear. And yeah, Amy Goodman has a nice Breaking the Sound Barrier essay on MLK voting rights. That was an amazing quote from the Constitution. I didn't recollect hearing that it expired in 1808, the clause about an unamendable part of the Constitution. Funny I didn't hear about that ever before, because I read a bunch of dissident stuff. We'll go straight to Greg Palast, talking about voting rights, is usually bailiwick, then the archival material from him about Kazakhstan. It's in the news lately. The uprising seems to have been tried to be hijacked from the former by the former dictator. I guess he wanted a reprise. He installed the prime minister that is in power now, apparently, but apparently his designee was not doing everything that he wanted to do and he'd rather do it himself. But apparently that didn't work. Hijacking uprisings, legitimate voices of dissent is a common phenomenon. In fact, my argument is that's what happened in Maidan in Kiev, that was hijacked. When some of the people involved in it on the periphery became central and burned down a union hall, killing a lot of people inside, that sort of clarified the mind about who was running the show. You may not remember that incident. There's a lot of stuff that we don't remember. And then to remind you just a bit of what Ray McGovern, longtime CIA analyst, he briefed seven different presidents and now is a dissident with Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, VIPS, formed at the time of the run-up to the Iraq War, fixing the intelligence, as the famous Downing Street memo said, if I'm recalling correctly. But he's still been doing a lot of work. I haven't heard him interviewed lately, and he's lamenting that he hasn't been getting calls from even community and alternative media, so I probably owe him a phone call. And then Arun Gupta, that's the rundown, and we'll see how much we can get on. There's something is sizzling in the background. I should go check to see. That's not really just me or something. Oh, darn it. Yeah, I guess we'll get less of that than I thought, since I just remembered that Mumia has a excellent memorial for Sidney Poitier. And let's see if I can pull that up real quick. I was supposed to be doing that while I was getting ready here. And okay. Here we go. This is brilliant.
Sir Sidney Poitier. For nearly a century, Sir Sidney Poitier lived and worked in the United States, an actor who consciously, intentionally sought and refused roles based upon the portrayal of black people. If the roles were demeaning or offensive, he passed on them. if the roles were enlightening or the character could be played with dignity, he took them. Born to parents from the Bahamas during a vacation in the U.S., Poitier, who spent years working in his father's tomato farm on the island, came to America, fell in love with the stage, and experienced his first hard knock when he was denied study at the American Negro Theater because of his heavy Bahamian accent. Poitier didn't despair. He practiced speaking in an American accent for months, reapplied, and gained acceptance to the company. Before long, the stage became the screen, where he left an indelible mark. In 1951, he made Cry, the Beloved Country, a British-made film set in apartheid-era South Africa. In 1958, he co-starred in The Defiant Ones with Tony Curtis, portraying two prison escapees fighting to survive despite being shackled together. In 1967, he played in a series of films which addressed the racist nature of the times, as a teacher in To Sir with Love, as a police detective in The Heat of the Night, and as part of an interracial marriage in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, at a time when such marriages were illegal in several dozen states. Poitier won an Oscar for Best Actor for his performance in Lilies of the Field, 1964, a rare honor for a black actor then and now. Poitier, in a 1967 interview, made the following observations. I've learned that I must find positive outlets for anger, or it will destroy me. There is a certain anger. It reaches such intensity that to express it fully would require homicidal rage, self-destructive, destroy the world rage. And its flame burns because the world is so unjust. Sir Sidney Poitier. In the 90s, Poitier played Nelson Mandela in a made-for-TV movie. Mandela was imprisoned when it was screened in South Africa and said it gave him hope. Mandela also saw Poitier in The Heat of the Night. But what he didn't know until he left prison was that the South African censors had cut out Poitier's scene of slapping a white man who had struck him. Sir Sidney Poitier, who I enjoyed in the film he both starred in alongside Harry Belafonte and Ruby Dee, and directed the Western Buck and the Preacher, 1972, about ex-slaves fleeing the South to find freedom out West. Poitier lived 94 summers as a man who turned rage into art. He was father to six daughters and husband to two wives. The last, retired actress Joanna Shimkus, born in Canada. Sidney Poitier lived a life of love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Thank you.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
I covered some films that I didn't hear in all of the reviews of his life that I'd heard elsewhere. Something I did hear that apparently is true, that he had a clause in his contract that said, my films can't be shown edited. That was a common practice in the U.S. There would be a version for the South and for Texas. But he said no, but obviously an outlaw colonial settler state like South Africa probably just went ahead and did it. It's a pretty moving scene, actually. Okay, to move right along, I'll let you know where you can go to flashpoints.net and look for the material we're going to hear. And Rising Up with Sonali has a good interview with Arun Gupta. who I remember first wrote for the Occupy Wall Street Journal, which was the journal of the times in the Occupy front, in that movement, and that he also wrote for Indy, I think, in New York, which was the independent media newsprint newspaper, which I won't say anything more about right now, since we want to get back to the program, which is now Breaking the Sound Barrier with Amy Goodman.
Martin Luther King's birthday, the racist filibuster, and the fight for voting rights. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. U.S. democracy is in crisis as Republican supporters of the January 6th Capitol insurrection restrict or even eliminate democracy's core tenet of one person, one vote. Former President Donald Trump is driving democracy's demise, spouting the big lie that the 2020 election was stolen from him through massive voter fraud. Countless audits, over 60 court cases, and both Democratic and Republican state secretaries of state confirmed President Joe Biden trounced Trump by over 7 million votes. Nevertheless, Republican shills up and down the party power structure, from House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy to operatives at the state and local level, have embraced Trump's big lie, ramping up voter suppression, gerrymandering, and the use of dark money to ensure they can grab power and hold it indefinitely, even as the GOP is shrinking as a share of the electorate. Two bills are currently before the Senate to stop this slide into authoritarianism, the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. Similar versions have already passed in the House. Senate Democrats must first overcome Republican filibusters, though. The filibuster has long been used to derail civil rights legislation in the Senate, and now is no different. It normally takes 60 of the 100 senators to defeat a filibuster, currently an insurmountable barrier in the face of Republican opposition. Democrats could use a targeted override of the filibuster, a carve-out, which would need the votes of all 50 members of the Senate Democratic Caucus, along with the tie-breaking vote of Vice President Kamala Harris. But two conservative Senate Democrats, Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, have indicated they likely won't support the maneuver.
Do you want to be on the side of Dr. King or George Wallace?
So asked President Biden at a speech in Atlanta on Wednesday, advocating for the temporary filibuster override needed to advance these voting rights bills.
Do you want to be on the side of John Lewis or Bull Connor? Do you want to be the side of Abraham Lincoln or Jefferson Davis?
Bull Connor was the brutal white supremacist commissioner of public safety in Birmingham, Alabama, during most of the civil rights era. Biden's reference to Bull Connor echoed a Nation magazine article written by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in March of 1964, as activists were pushing for passage of the Civil Rights Act. Dr. King wrote, "As had been foreseen, the bill survived intact in the House. It has now moved to the Senate, where a legislative confrontation reminiscent of Birmingham impends. Bull Connor became a weight too heavy for the conscience of Birmingham to bear. There are men in the Senate who now plan to perpetuate the injustices Bull Connor so ignobly defended. His weapons were the high-pressure hose, the club, and the snarling dog. Theirs is the filibuster. If America is as revolted by them as it was by Bull Connor, we shall emerge with a victory." Again, that essay written by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in 1964. It appeared 4 months after President Kennedy's assassination and 9 months before King received the Nobel Peace Prize. King wrote, "It is not too much to ask, 100 years after the emancipation, that senators who must meet the challenge of filibuster do so in the spirit of the heroes of Birmingham." Dr. King continued in that piece, invoking the powerful memory of the four young African-American girls killed in the racist bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church on September 15, 1963, and two more youth killed in protests that immediately followed. King continued, there could be no more fitting tribute to the children of Birmingham than to have the Senate, for the first time in history, bury a civil rights filibuster. The dead children cannot be restored, but living children can be given a life. The assassins who still walk the streets will still be unpunished, but at least they will be defeated, King said. That filibuster eventually failed, and the Civil Rights Act became law, followed by the monumental Voting Rights Act of 1965. The VRA revolutionized African-American political participation in the U.S., especially in the Deep South. The right wing never stopped attacking it. Two recent Supreme Court decisions, Shelby versus Holder in 2013 and Brnovich versus the DNC in 2021, gutted the Voting Rights Act, unleashing a flood of gerrymandering and laws designed to reduce voter turnout, disenfranchising millions of voters from Democratic-leaning urban centers and other communities of color.
Frederick Douglass told us a long time ago, power can seize nothing without a demand.
That's the Georgia-based activist Cliff Albright, co-founder of Black Voters Matter, speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour from Atlanta. As we mark what would have been Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s 93rd birthday, now is the time to demand that the U.S. Senate override the Jim Crow filibuster and pass meaningful voting rights legislation. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
And I guess that's a dead letter. But there's still some great information in there. I think Biden should have given the speech that he gave in Georgia in the halls of Congress. And when he named those 16 senators on the Republican side who have voted for the Voting Rights Act in the past, who are still in the Senate, he should have named them. I don't know who they are, but some of the older senators. Yeah, maybe they'll quit, too, in disgust. Obviously not. All right, going to move right on to Greg Palast. A short segment from a longer discussion. It was also included a lot about how to lobby Manchin and maybe go for Murkowski. I don't know. It's rather depressing, MLK weekend. But Palast's argument is, well, we just have to out-organize it, even though the deck will be stacked against.
How you operate in the Senate. It may just come down to something simple, Dennis, having been in Georgia and Mississippi, Ohio, Florida, Pennsylvania, all these swing states. It's organizing. You can have the law, you can have the courts, but in the end, it's getting people registered, then re-registered after they're purged, contacting and calling them. In fact, one of the reasons why Reverend Warnock won, people know very little of this story, and John Ossoff in the January 5th runoff, is that activists, not the Democratic Party, but activists like the Black Voters Matter Fund and Rainbow Push and others, had massive phone banks that when one of Raffin's purger's minions disqualified someone's mail-in ballot, they contacted the people to go into their county offices and what was called cure their ballot. That is, if you're missing a signature, they don't like your signature, or you used a red pen instead of a blue pen, you can correct all these things. And they were shocked and stunned. Even Raffensperger, the GOP Secretary of State, he complained, well, the reason you guys lost is that they had a system to protect their ballots and Republicans didn't. You know, the Republicans didn't cure their ballots. There were very few Republican ballots thrown out, but a few, enough, frankly, that if the GOP had kept the Black voters out, but protected their own ballots, they could have given the state to Trump. So it was on the street, on the phone, at your door, organizing, not federal law, that changed, that flipped Georgia to the will of the voters.
Amazing. Again, we're speaking with Greg Palast. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we've been working with Greg benefiting, all of the Pacifica audience is benefiting from the amazing kind of reporting and research that Greg has done on this subject. He has been a bulldog, and we have had the privilege to go along with about 20 years of that ride. But clearly... Greg, all the terrible things that you reported in, for instance, in the Best Democracy Money Can Buy, all those things that everybody said, it's not going to get that bad. Look, here's one crazy example. You know, like, it's almost like I look back fondly on those earlier days of vote purging compared to where we are right now.
Well, actually, that's really true. In fact, I have to say, if you think I want to, this is now my 22nd year covering vote suppression, vote tactics, and God forbid you say the word vote theft. That's a big problem, too, is that it has gotten so much worse. I thought when I investigated and uncovered how Catherine Harris removed thousands of black people from the voter rolls, that, under false pretenses, saying they were felons, they're just guilty of voting while black. Not one was a felon, by the way, in Florida. What I didn't know is that instead of the exposure and the creation of a new law, another federal law, the Help America Vote Act, that should have ended it. It didn't end it. In fact, it helped spread it. That's why I'm always wary of people saying, oh, well, all we have to do is pass this legislation, we're fine. Well, we said that in 2003 with the signing of the Help America Vote Act, and what that did, it literally made things worse because we weren't watching, that is, the public wasn't watching. The Democratic Party was certainly asleep at the switch. I spoke with the party chairman at the time, Terry McAuliffe, and I said, you're getting people purged off the vote. I was interviewing him for BBC television. I said, people are being purged off the voter rolls nationwide on false pretenses, mainly black voters. What are you doing about it? He said, well, we're going to have lawyers at the polls on election day. It was the chairman of the Democratic Party. And I said, well, but if they're removed from the voter rolls, they can't vote. It doesn't matter how many lawyers they have. So what are you doing about that? He said, he looked at me blankly like, why is this even an issue? So the Democratic Party has been asleep. Maybe this speech today by Biden is suddenly like, a shot of caffeine for the Democratic
Party. I mean, on its own, it was pretty powerful for a president to give that speech. Yeah,
absolutely. I don't want to take, let's not take away the power and importance of words and the power of importance of saying, here's where I stand. But here's a guy who waited a year to say where he stood on this,
right,
or actually, waffled away from it. And that, and look, that's why the activists were saying, oh, thank you for just discovering us because you're panicked about losing a Democratic Senate seat. Well, we did this on the ground. Again, it was about giving people the right to vote, not the right to have a Democrat. And so I think that, it has gotten worse. So that, for example, the Help America Vote Act required the computerization of voter rolls nationwide. That made it easier to purge literally hundreds of thousands of people at the push of a button who don't know they've lost their vote till they show it up. The Help America Vote Act also created the provisional ballot. Now, we thought that was a good thing, or that's what the Black Caucus thought. They said if someone is purged and they show up, and they say, oh, well, I've been wrongly purged, well, they still get a ballot called a provisional ballot, and then they check their status. The problem is that they won the right for a provisional ballot, but have no right, zero right, to have that ballot counted. So if you were wrongly called a felon who can't vote in Georgia, which still has that law, that Jim Crow law, if you're wrongly identified as a felon, they'll say, oh, well, you were wrongly identified as a felon. We can't count your vote now, but we'll let you register for the next election. That's what they do. So just federal law alone cannot save you because they will manipulate it, they will twist it, and they have made it literally using so-called voting reform laws, they've made it worse. Now they're out of the closet. They don't even pretend that it's voting protection. They call it voter election integrity protection to stop the fraudulent voters.
Right.
Who I'm still waiting for them to name.
Right.
Short excerpt from Palast. We're going to go on and hear something he did a few years ago. It was 2016, I guess. And like I said, I was going to do some controversial stuff since we've just been hearing him. We'll hear how much younger he listens. We won't be getting much of the Arun Gupta on. I've had two segments, and I won't even get all of the first segment on. But you can find him at flashpoints.net over 2 days, and also, as I mentioned, Rising Up with Sonali has an earlier interview, which predates the Oath Keepers roundup. But this should have a little context, which is he was, other than following elections, he was an economics reporter. Actually worked for the Treasury Department investigating corporations at some earlier stage of life. He was wearing a different fedora at the time. Here he's really angry about Kazakhstan and money going to the Clinton Foundation. And people will have a knee-jerk response that I'm jumping on with right-wingers, but as he puts it, whoever does the investigation, if they can demonstrate the facts, and he says he knows that this money was paid, et cetera, by a, what I call a Canadian oligarch. I don't have a segment here where he mentions that the previous dictator of Kazakhstan gave him $500,000 to give a speech in Almaty, in capital of Kazakhstan. I guess I'm saying that a little bit wrong. It's in the news. I should remember it. But the context of this is the whole Clinton era, Yeltsin, Clinton, and the looting of the Soviet Union assets. It didn't go just to these oligarchs we hear about on the Russian side. Many, many Western groups were involved in the this, what I call looting. And it's a big grievance by the Russian people that Putin gets to play upon, but we don't even talk about it here. So as a remedy to that, we're going to hear Palast talk about it.
Well, it was because there were Freedom of Information Act requests for her documents from journalists like me. And what they wanted to do is tell us that these documents, that these emails, these subjects didn't exist. I was interested in finding out of Hillary Clinton's relationship to the dictatorship, the murderous dictatorship of Kazakhstan. Now, let's follow the money here. And this is a story reported by The Times, The New Yorker, and yes, a right-wing investigator named Peter Schweitzer, who I find, you know, he may be right-wing, but he's a straightforward investigator. And from, and I went to Kazakhstan to check out these stories, Seymour Hersh too. And we had a guy named Frank Justra, who is a big resource magnate, and he gave $30 million to the Clinton Foundation, which he said was, he literally termed it an investment. Now, that's the Hillary, Bill, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation. And then Justra flew to Kazakhstan and got the exclusive agreement to mine the uranium from Kazakhstan. This is when nuclear power was making an ugly little comeback, coming out of its crypt. Right after Justra shows up, Bill Clinton shows up. This guy just got $30 million from Justra. He shows up and he meets privately with the president of Kazakhstan. Hmm. Okay, now, Hillary Clinton becomes Secretary of State. Seymour Hersh, myself, and others discovered that there was massive bribery paid by U.S. oil companies to the president of Kazakhstan, Nursultan Nazarbayev. And a mobile executive went to prison for the bribery payments. But Nazarbayev himself, the president of Kazakhstan, who received the money, about $160 million in bribes, they don't come cheap, these oil potentates, $160 million in bribes. But his name was never mentioned in the indictment of the criminals of the bribers who went to jail. And rather, he was listed as something called KO2 or Kazakh Official 2. Now, why do we care about that? Because my inside sources at the Justice Department told me that that was arranged by Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, that she sent her deputy to Kazakhstan and assured the dictator who, and by the way, you don't want to get on the wrong side of the dictator because journalists tend to end up dead in Kazakhstan for doing that. Nazarbayev said that anyone in his nation who mentions that he is subject of a bribery investigation or that he had taken bribes goes to prison, and they're lucky if they come back out in with all their fingers on. So what Hillary Clinton did was she, by taking his name out of the indictment and just putting in those initials KO2, it may seem minor, but what that did is allowed this guy to clamp down, imprison, and torture journalists in his nation who would bring up the question of bribery from oil companies. Now, did Hillary Clinton do that to favor the oil companies, to stroke a bloodthirsty oil potentate in the Caspian Sea? Or did she do that to make sure that her foundation kept getting pleasured by Mr. Zhustra? And I can tell you, having been in Kazakhstan and talked to the president, the dictator, and his daughter, who's the dictator in waiting, they understand how these things work. Gentlemen don't say, hey, I'm going to take care of you, Nur Sultan, and help you get rid of your enemies and evil journalists. Rather, they understand how the system works. She takes care of Nazarbayev. That is, Secretary Clinton took care of Nazarbayev's needs, and he took care of the Clinton's benefactors' needs. And that's how it works. And all I wanted to do was get the information, any emails between Hillary and her husband regarding this transaction. But according to Hillary Clinton, that's a personal message because it's to her husband. Well, it's not really to her husband. It's to her co-recipient of millions of dollars. They run a business together, basically, called the Clinton Foundation, and a political operation called the Clinton Campaign.
That's actually from 2014, archival material from Greg Palast. Pretty incendiary, I think. As is the next short segment with McGovern. And like I said, the context of this is the larceny in after the breakup of the Soviet Union and looting, I think is a fair word to call it. Shared in by many around the world, not just by the oligarchs that we get to hear about all the time. There are lots of oligarchs of different stripes and flavors, if you will. I think I dislike ours more than theirs. And I'm supposed to be able to do more about the ones that we harbor, who use tax shelters and high-speed arbitrage and derivative trading. This whole press, whole late capitalist, I can't say that on the air. This is, again, Ray McGovern. I played this in a couple of different contexts. This is only a 3-minute segment where he crystallizes the idea of the invasion of Crimea.
Right these days, what do the people in Crimea want? Now, that was everyone knew what they wanted. They're Russian stock mostly, and they feed off the naval base there. And, you know, everyone knew that if there was a plebiscite, they would vote to rejoin Russia. And so they had a plebiscite, and they asked to rejoin Russia, and Russia annexed them. Again, let's use just very plain words. They re-annexed Crimea. Now, that became a cause célèbre, of course. This was interpreted as a Russian invasion. Now, you know, it's important to point out, and I ran into this during the time I was giving talks, and one professor said to me, but what about all those people that were killed when Russia invaded and seized Crimea? And I said, well, how many people was that? And she said, oh, I don't know, thousands. I said, actually, no one was killed. Oh, come on. No, really. No one was killed. Not one person was wounded. How did it happen? The Russians had permission from Ukraine to have 30,000 troops there to protect their naval base. And what they did, pretty adroitly, was they went around to the various governmental institutions in Crimea and said, look, you don't know what Kiev is instructing you to do. We know what Moscow is instructing us to do. Please step aside because we're taking over Crimea. Not a shot was fired in anger. No one was killed. It was a what they call these, there was no insignia. They had these troops that just came in and did that. Troops already there. No invasion. Meanwhile, of course, the people in the Donbas, in the eastern, southeastern part of Ukraine, who were also primarily Russian stock and didn't want any part of the coup regime, they said they didn't. They wouldn't abide by the coup regime, and they started fighting for their independence as they saw it, with help from the Russians, not Russian units, military units, but what they call volunteers, the kind of people that we send into battle to help our own allies. So there was no Russian invasion. The head of NATO said, oh, there were 30,000 troops amassed on the Ukrainian border. That was a lie, and it fell to us, actually. This is interesting. It fell to us veteran intelligence professionals for sanity to tell the German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, that this was a lie, that Air Force General Breedlove, the head of NATO, was lying when he said there were these mass Soviet troops or Russian troops there. So it's a very complicated situation. The next thing that happened, of course, was that the U.S. Did everything they could to exploit this Russian invasion.
Veteran of the CIA, not an agent, but an analyst. He briefed 7 different presidents, Ray McGovern. He publishes at Consortium News. He's got a great tongue-in-cheek article from a couple of years ago called Ukraine for Dummies that I recommend. It includes a link to Victoria Nuland's famous leaked phone message where she said blank the EU and also celebrated the fact that they were going to install the leader they wanted, and they did. All right, this has run much longer. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily shared by others at the station. I think the commonplaces of our discourse about Russia are totally polluted. There was a Democracy Now! Segment with Katrina Vandenhoevel, wife of the late Russian scholar Stephen Cohen, who took a lot of hits in his late years. She's also the editor of The Nation magazine, and they are publishing some anecdotes to the commonplace discourse, it seems to me. All right, Aaron Gupto, we're only going to get about 22 minutes, it looks like, before Radio Free Labor folks come in. And he's got about 15 minutes of interview with Dennis Bernstein's flashpoints.net is where you can find the entirety of it over 2 days. And an earlier interview prior to the Oath Keepers roundup with Sonali Kalatkar at Rising Up with Sonali. Aaron Gupta is a regular correspondent for, our analyst, I guess, for Sonali Kalatkar on that show out of KPFK. So, without further ado, there was something else there, but I'll let it hang in the air. And this is the more one. I need the other one. Oh. Well, I guess this isn't the one I wanted to play, but you can find the rest of the Gupta interview with at flashpoints.net. How did that happen?
Leaders.
Yeah, the ringleader would be Donald Trump.
And, you know, the members of his staff, you know, basically everyone who is now refusing to comply with the congressional subpoenas, we can be clear, our underlings, you know, folks like Mark Meadows, you know, there's a lot of suspicion about who are the members of Congress that we've heard all these reports and indications were meeting with the coup plotters before January 6th. But I think that's right to call the Oath Keepers and then the other kind of gangs and militias like the Proud Boys and the Three Percenters more the field commanders of the January 6th insurrection.
All right. Tell us again a little bit more about who Elmore Rhodes is and who Edward Vallejo. They were the they were arrested. They well, Rhodes is identified with the Oath Keepers. I guess they both are. Tell us more about who they are and what role they played in the attempt to overthrow the elections.
Sure. So Rhodes is really the key figure here. He is the one who helped, or he's the one who founded the Oath Keepers in 2009 in April, which, you know, what is happening at that point? Well, we have the nation's first black president. And what's noteworthy about it, I mean, all this stuff is just, there's a certain comical nature to it. It's absurd, but as I've been saying, it's comical, but it's no joke, because these guys were plotting a violent overthrow against the U.S. government. So he sets up Oath Keepers in Lexington, Massachusetts, which, of course, you know, he's trying to appeal to the whole Revolutionary War mythology and imagery. And he sets it up with one of the leaders of the Three Percenters, which is a more decentralized and more violent than Oath Keepers militia, as well as one of the leaders of, I think it's something like the Constitutional Sheriffs Association or something like that. So these are Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association. And they, I think, are pretty dangerous. These are actually elected sheriffs. And, you know, I don't think there's enough discussion on just the really dangerous nature of sheriffs when we talk about policing. It's something like nearly 85% of them are white men. The constitutional sheriffs think they are the highest law in the land. They overlap with sovereign citizens, which is one of the most extremely violent right-wing ideologies. So these are the type of people who Stuart Rhodes is bringing together. And the Oath Keepers are not the most extreme organizations. But over the years, especially during the Trump years, and especially they really first kind of come to prominence during the Clive and Bundy battle with the Bureau of Land Management. This is basically the criminal whose cattle were illegally grazing on federal lands for over 21 years, and he owed the BLM $1.2 million in grazing fees. And it should be added, those grazing fees on public lands are about one-tenth of what ranchers pay on private land. And so the BLM, after various court cases, after trying to deal with him for years, you know, asking him to pay, they finally got an agreement to round up his cattle. And Clive and Bundy called for a range war, and the Oath Keepers were one of the groups that answered that call. There were also Three Percenters there. And that is really a seminal moment going back to April of 2014, because by that point there had been something like a 400% rise in, I believe, hate groups and a 600% rise in militias, or maybe it's the other way around. And so it's this explosive growth during the Obama years of right-wing extremism. But it was the Bundys who really start to bring them all together for the first time. And that whole event, you know, it ended with these militiamen surrounding BLM officials, and they're often called like police or agents, but many of them weren't. You know, they're just like conservation biologists, or they handle, you know, land management issues. And so the militiamen surround them with sniper rifles, and basically the government backs out. They surrender, and they pull out all government employees, and they let the Bundys have their cattle back. But after that, the Oath Keepers and Stuart Rhodes are still down there. And the thing about, you know, just all these right-wing groups, all these militias, they are a product of paranoia, so they're steeped in paranoia. Stuart Rhodes claims that he has this information that Obama is going to launch a drone strike on the Bundy Ranch. And so they basically bug out. At one point, the Oath Keepers and other militias all pull guns on each other, and they're screaming at each other, and it nearly devolved into a firefight. You know, that's what I say. It's like, it's all kind of comical, but these guys are trying to overthrow the government. They want civil war. They want an insurrection. And from the beginning of the founding of the Oath Keepers, it was all about there's going to be a second revolutionary war. So it's basically this group that is has been in search of an insurrection, which means they're trying to bring this insurrection and civil war into being that they have been fantasizing about. And, you know, one of the, I think, amusing elements about Elmer Stuart Rhodes is he is a graduate of Yale Law School, just like Clarence Thomas, who was one of the five justices who legalized the 2000 coup, and that was a coup in Bush versus Gore, the stolen election. So you have these various, and you know, Bush himself, of course, went to Yale and part of the whole skull and crossbones society, that kind of like secret skullduggery CIA linked organization at Yale. And so these are elites in many ways that we're talking about. These aren't, you know, the way I think a lot of liberals like to portray them, as like, you know, down and out rednecks sitting on their sofas in their front yard cleaning their, you know, 70-year-old shotgun. These are people who, you know, are essentially part of the ruling class in a lot of way, who are instigating and even participating in this revolt. And when you look at the indictment, most of what it concerns is the means, how they were going about trying to carry out the insurrection on January 6th. So they're setting up various signal groups and chat threads. And so obviously the government has been able to flip some people within the Oath Keepers. I believe there's up to four who are already cooperating with the government. So they've gotten access to a lot of these encrypted conversations. And they're talking about setting up quick reaction forces in Virginia because they couldn't bring guns into D.C. legally. That they talked about, like, you know, having boats to ferry men and weapons across the river into D.C. They have two, what they call Stack 1 and Stack 2. These were the two teams of Oath Keepers that helped to violently breach the Capitol and then were fighting with the police inside. So the indictment really lays out a lot of how they actually participated. And it's clear if you look in the indictment that there's going to be video that backs this up. And, you know, they'll probably like be introducing witnesses if this goes to trial. And, you know, hopefully they're going to go away for a long time, maybe the rest of their lives. But in a lot of ways, you know, this is kind of the horse has left its pen. The horse has already left its pen, and the government is closing the gate. For instance, I wrote, right, the most recent piece I wrote for The Raw Story is on how Portland was a proving ground, how the police in Portland really just got into this relationship with the Proud Boys back to 2017, so 5 years ago, that slowly evolved another extremist. And basically, they let the Proud Boys turn Portland into a proving ground where they were able to network with other extremist groups, build ties, build organizational capacity, come there, commit violence with impunity, and then use images of that violence to gain new recruits with the promise of future violence. And this all feeds into January 6th. And it's out in the Pacific Northwest, you know, and some of these characters had been involved in the 2016 Bundy occupation. There were actually at least three Oath Keepers. You know, they were kind of burned after the Nevada incident because a lot of the other militias were like laughing at them and even saying that they were going to shoot them for being traitors and cowards. But and the Oath Keepers took an official position of not supporting the Malheur occupation. That's where the Bundy brothers, Eamon and Ryan, took over the wildlife refuge in eastern Oregon. But there were numerous Oath Keepers who were out there with the support of Stuart Rhodes, supporting the occupation or inside the occupation. And then by the beginning of the next year, 2017, that's when you start to see Patriot Prayer and Proud Boy events in Portland, and the police kind of just letting this violence run unchecked. And then throughout the Pacific Northwest, Proud Boys and Patriot Prayer start to make links to these militia groups like Oath Keepers and Three Percenters. So it really is just this kind of evolutionary stew of violence, of white nationalism, of this insurrectionist mentality that is breeding out there for years unchecked, and that eventually is goes on the road to D.C. That's the thing, you know. Eventually, the Proud Boys in the fall of 2020 decided, okay, Portland had served its purpose. They had grown this national organization of hundreds of violent-minded white nationalists and fascists, and they started going to D.C. If we recall in the fall of 2020, in and around the election, to have these riots that were really not properly policed in D.C., and that then culminates in January 6th.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we are running out of time. So what I want to do with you now is really hone in on the fact that this is really a tried and true white supremacist operation. It was very interesting to me when Trump announced his run for the presidency. The first major national politician was a guy by the name of Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III. And if there was ever a racist, he couldn't even get Republicans to support him for a federal judge. He was such an out-of-control racist. But everybody, you know, that was sort of a sign that he had, that Trump had entered the, you know, he was getting more middle of the road and more acceptable. Here's a seasoned senator who accepted him. But anybody who knows anything about Sessions knows we're talking about hard right, extreme white supremacists who spent a lifetime trying to suppress what, black people's right to vote. And that was where we started with Trump.
And his infamous quote about the Klan, right? Sessions quote, that is his problem. He only had a problem with the Klan because they smoked pot. wasn't that they carried out this campaign of racial terrorism for 100 years? It was that they smoked weed. The interesting thing about the Oath Keepers, you know, there's some like researchers on extremism. There's a guy at the ADL, Anti Defamation League, who's like, oh, they're not white supremacists, and you know, it just like, technically, that's true. They make a big deal about like, oh, we oppose racism and they're open to members of color. But when you look at what they're actually doing, it is thoroughly steeped with a white supremacist outlook, and they have all sorts of cross crossovers with white nationalism. So they, the Oath Keepers showed up in 2014 in Ferguson. They were on the rooftops. They were patrolling the streets. Even the police said, you know, of course, and of course, the police were being totally violent against black people, this structural racism of the state. And the police were saying that they're inflammatory. But Stuart Rhodes was, you know, saying that these are thugs on the street. So, you know, he's using outright this racist language himself. And they're, you know, acting as kind of this extrajudicial militia, you know, and there's this, there, America is founded on this, right? You know, slave patrols, anti-Indian militias. So they are very much in that vein. In 2018, the Oath Keepers go down for this border operation to patrol the border against an immigrant invasion. And, you know, Stuart Rhodes is ranting about how there's this, like, illegal invasion. He's basically promoting the Great Replacement Theory, this neo-Nazi conspiracy that there's these sinister forces who are trying to replace white people. And the origins of these border patrols go back to the 70s with the Klan and the neo-Nazis. The Oath Keepers have showed up in 2017. You know, what they'll often do is, and the thing about Rhodes is you have to understand, he has generally been somewhat risk-averse, so he's not an outlier. Like, you can see similarities between the Oath Keepers and the Boogaloo Boys, which they are also insurrectionists, like the Oath Keepers. They're also like fantasizing about a civil war, but they tend to be more extreme. They're accelerationists, right? That is, the Oath Keepers until January 6th did not have any evidence of being accelerationists. And accelerationism is this mainly right-wing ideology that we have to bring the race war, the civil war, into being with acts of terror. And so, you know, Boogaloo Boys have been involved in numerous acts of terror, attempted bombings. There's been a number of killings that they've been involved with. Some 3%ers have also been involved with that, but not the Oath Keepers per se. But the Oath Keepers consistently show up at these demonstrations. So in 2017, they show up and are in Berkeley. They're guarding the Rise Again movement, which is one of the most extreme neo-Nazi organizations. They are accelerationists, and they want to essentially start a race war. They've also provided security for Act for America, which is this extreme anti-Islam, immigrant and Islamophobic group in this march against Sharia. They were providing security for Vanguard America and Identity Europa, two other kind of fascist, explicit fascist organizations. So on the one hand, you know, they kind of have this cover and even maybe, you know, somewhat of belief, oh, we're not racist. But when you look at what they're actually saying and what they're actually doing, there's a lot of crossover between them and white nationalism. And of course, the whole thing that I think really shows how the Oath Keepers, ultimately white nationalists, they were founded, as you know, we've been talking about, during the first few months of the Obama administration. And it's all about how we need to protect people from government tyranny, and we're going to have to go to war against the government. Yet when Trump comes into office, they flip 180 degrees. And suddenly it's, we need to protect Trump. And the enemies are Black Lives Matter. It's immigrants. It's Islam. It's anti-fascist. It's basically the people who are the most oppressed, who are subject to the most government tyranny, or trying to defend others against government tyranny. So that is really, I think, ultimately the common thread, is that, you know, it is this kind of, you know, sub rosa white nationalism that we've seen burst into the open. And when it comes to the assault on the Capitol on January 6th, that was thoroughly white nationalist, because it is motivated by this ideology and history of that white people that these are white people's institutions and we can use whatever violence we want is justified in taking them back. And then they come with the explicit imagery of white nationalism, right? Confederate flags with nooses. There's the guy who's wearing the Camp Auschwitz t-shirts. There are numerous white nationalists who are present that day.
6 million aren't enough, and on we go. We have to leave it right there, right now. But Arun Gupta, thank you for coming back and following up. We appreciate it. I want to recommend people to your series, ongoing series at Raw Stories. You've been published widely. You've worked with The Intercept and many wonderful places, The Nation, Washington Post, whatever. But right now, check this work out by Arun Gupta at Raw Story. Really, it's important. Stay with us.
Well, you can't stay with him. And that was the part two. I was going to play part one. This was more of a historical piece. In the other one, he talks more about the indictment. And he is very sensitive to the fact that, you know, there are other forces, if you will, late capitalism. It isn't just these gun nuts, but they can be used as a tool, it seems to me. Opinions are those of the speakers. This hour programming is brought to you by the Urbana Park District and the listeners of WEFT. The Urbana Indoor Aquatic Center is open 7 days a week throughout the fall season. For more information, please visit www.urbanaparks.org. I think it's done by appointment, and maybe I should consider getting back in the water and get some more exercise. Hope springs eternal. Stay safe, stay on your feet, stay in if you're feeling bad, right?